My name's Councillor Joss Clark, councillor for Brislington West Ward, also the leader of the Bristol Lib Dems.
Can you just give us an idea of the Lib Dems' past in Bristol? Because I know we've got a mayoral system now. Actually, the administration which Barbara Jenk led before the mayor system was a Lib Dem. It was a Lib Dem administration actually running the city, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Obviously, our political fortunes have slightly changed in Bristol over the years. We did run the administration, we did run the council under a leader and cabinet system. And in latter years, we finished in numbers in terms of councillors in Bristol.
Now, couldn't you just explain the way it works? Because I think for many people, it's easier to understand how one person, i.e. a mayor, can run the city who we elect. It's less easy to understand why we need 70 councillors or so, and how politicians figure out from amongst those 70 one that should become the council leader.
Right, so it'll be proportionate. So we'll have a committee. We'll have committees set up as we do currently. The names of the committees, the portfolios within those committees may well be slightly different. That has all to be decided, and the number of committees may change. There may be more, there may be less. We obviously have statutory committees, which we, like planning and licensing, which will stay the same. The chair of the committee will be effectively very similar to an executive member, and obviously the not obviously but the largest group in the city will become the leader of the council by a different name.
I know it just sounds a little bit complicated, but it's a system which worked for a long, long time. And also, it means that, if there's a council leader is doing or saying unpopular things, that they may not carry on for their full term.
Well, yeah. And with at the moment, we've got a system where we have elected a mayor and they are in post for 4 years. But with the leader and cabinet system, and also with the committee system, you have more opportunity to change the leader of the council. So things can be more fluid if things aren't going well. But that's not to say that things will go badly.
Now, one of the criticisms of the mayor, and Bristol has just rejected this whole idea of having a mayor, they've basically, the people have said, with a reasonable majority, that this system hasn't been working. So, can you just explain? I mean, you've got a mayor and a cabinet. What sort of role do they play? Because there has been the criticism that this is basically a sort of selected group of people, selected by the mayor, who also get paid more, and it's a kind of almost become like a kind of patronage where the mayor can give these extra jobs to his friends, or her friends, where, well, we haven't had a female mayor, but so
No,
the idea being that there's a balance here between whether the right person is in that cabinet role or whether it's someone who is part of a clique.
yeah, I mean, what we've seen in under the mayoral system under Labour, you're absolutely right that it appears that as long as they agree with the mayor stroke leader, then they will survive. If they don't, they're probably never going to get anywhere near being in the executive. We saw that a little bit right at the beginning when we had a rainbow cabinet, and people were very unceremoniously sacked from the political groups apart from Labour. Basically, they found out because their diaries were emptied, and that was it. That's how they found out they'd been sacked by the mayor, which is not great, really.
No, well, it's the sort of thing you might expect in a kind of shark-ridden pool in big business, but not in a local authority, Joss. And I wonder if you could just explain, what you've seen and the kind of change of culture over the last decade or so, under the mayor system, and particularly under this most recent mayor, Marvin Rees, the Labour guy, allegedly Labour, anyway, the actual change of culture from public service to this kind of behaviour.
What we see now is we have seen a change of culture within the council. Before we had the when we had the leader in cabinet, there were many negative things about it, but there were also some positive things. What I see now is that the mayor's behaviour towards opposition councillors is not respectful. We don't get an opportunity to really have it feed into the mayor's office, even though he says his door's always open and he's willing to listen. I have to tell you from my experience that is not necessarily the case, and he's not that available. And I think we've seen some really bad behaviour from the mayor, being really disrespectful to people in full council, and that is the most public thing that we do.
Can you give us some examples
of poor behaviour in full council? Well, I think it was the, remembering back, about the November full council from memory, where Marvin was incredibly rude to Lily, the youngest councillor, really disrespectful to her, and he was also very rude to Carla Denyer, both of which are Green councillors, that may be just incidental. And actually, the Lib Dems wrote to the mayor and said that this behaviour was not really how we should conduct ourselves in public, and it wasn't necessary.
Joss, you say rude. It may be that he's just being frank and abrupt.
He was rude.
In what way?
Well, he was rude because he came back in his, you know, in his patronising, in a very patronising way, unnecessarily so. And of course, the councillor didn't have any right of reply, which it makes it very difficult. And it wasn't acceptable. It wasn't acceptable. And we wrote to the mayor's office.
So what was the issue over?
There were two different issues. It was just the fact that they'd both spoken, and he was just very belittling of both of them. It wasn't a single issue.
Okay.
I mean, I saw him being very, very rude to a doctor who'd come to full council about pollution outside the BRI. And he was unnecessary. And of course, that individual did not have any right to reply either. It's not good. It's not necessary either. Not necessary.
The other thing we've got is some serious problems with the spatial strategy for planning. At the moment, there is an enormous push by developers to build on cheap greenfield sites. They want to make more profits, quite obviously. And also, they're being pushed by central government to just build more houses wherever they can. So can you just explain what's going on there?
So the... obviously, we all know in Bristol that there are issues with the WECA organisation and the relationship between WECA and the unitary authorities in Bristol is not great. The spatial strategy has collapsed, which it was a document which would have set out how many and where housing and the infrastructure would be over the coming years. And that document fell apart. It was so badly written that the officers weren't able to correct it. So it's just been thrown out. What that means to Bristol is we've lost a layer of what I would call protection, because it's open season really for developers now. If they want to do a development, they can just put in an application, because we don't have the protection at the moment of the spatial strategy, which would have helped us to protect our green spaces. The formula, I believe, is that you've got to have 5 years development in the pipeline. And if you don't, then obviously green belt becomes more vulnerable, because developers can come forward and say, we don't have enough development opportunities, we need to look at the green belt. And that is really worrying. We do have quite a lot of, obviously, brownfield site. But as you indicated, a lot of them are polluted. Lots of them have got buildings on already, etc., etc. So I've got real concerns. And I would think all the councils around the edge of the city, Hengrove, obviously Bishopsworth, all those, we are concerned of, you know, protecting our green spaces.
Yeah, one of the MPs is saying around Bristol is saying that in South Bristol there's 12,000 new homes going in, and the GPs, in other words, the schools and the doctors' surgeries, won't be able to cope with all these new people arriving because these homes are being built without infrastructure.
Which is, is a common, it does seem to be a common issue that comes up year after year. And with these large, we've got some large developments coming down the tracks. Obviously, Hengrove Park is large development. So you've got these large conurbations coming up, and we need secondary school places. We know that we've got problems with secondary school places. We know that the development of the new secondary schools aren't happening to meet actually pupil demand. So we're going to have to, these kids are going to have to be temporarily homed in porter cabins before these schools come on track. Yeah, you're right. We those are real considerations.
Yeah, but of course, if you've got a proper planning strategy, then that infrastructure is part of it. You don't give planning permission to for vast housing estates without some kind of consideration for the basic things like shops, schools, churches, these sorts of things. Anyway, also I noticed that former Lord Mayor in the Bristol Post this week, Joss, has been saying that he thinks that full council meetings are almost entirely pointless. I think that's, I'm not sure of his second name, Steve, the former,
Stu Smith.
Steve Smith, that's right, the Tory. Almost entirely pointless is his quote.
I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that it is a public-facing meeting. There are many things that are wrong with full council. This is obviously coming out of a comment that the new Lord Mayor made about written speeches. She feels that we should have live debate, as it were. But that's I've got reservations about that. I remember when we didn't read from our iPads, and the quality of debate, I have to tell you, was no better.
Yeah, there's been a similar debate at Westminster, hasn't there, about whether politicians in these debates should, I mean, obviously you could maybe have a few notes, a few bullet points, but should read pre-prepared written speeches. I think at Westminster, the main concern was that the speech might not actually even be written by the person that's reading it.
Oh, and that's the same in Bristol. I have listened to speeches made by people, and I have to tell you, it was probably the second time they've ever seen those words. I think a lot of Labour speeches are not written by Labour councillors. I put money on it.
Okay.
Absolutely. Honestly, seriously, I would put money on it.
So where do you stand on that one anyway?
There are very few people in the chamber who can speak off the cuff. I would say the only person who can really do that with any authority would be Mark Weston. He's a very good speaker. And there are very few people in the chamber who would be able to speak with any kind of credibility, I think, off the cuff.
Yeah, I think this is something that certainly the public, I mean, I'm not sure about the press, but certainly the public have got much more respect for somebody, especially in the heat of debate, that can think on their feet rather than have to think using somebody else's words on their iPad. But anyway, an interesting comment made by Steve Smith about it being pointless and,
Well,
you know.
yeah, if I can just come in about motions, I mean, I think that, there's a lot of, we spend a lot of time thinking about and writing motions on the off chance that we win the silver motion, we get more than our fair share through in the year, because obviously the motions is where it becomes interesting. But motions are only advisory, they're not, there's nothing there that actually the council has a duty to act upon. And that is quite depressing, really. So you can pass a motion about, I don't know, doesn't matter what it is. But actually, as a councillor, I know that it's not necessarily going to get implemented. I remember Mark Wright in probably about 2019, he got a motion through about no idling outside schools to reduce pollution levels outside schools. Nothing wrong with that. I think everybody would get behind that sentiment, wouldn't we? But nothing's ever happened. I've never seen a sign go up outside a school saying if you're sitting outside the school in your car, please turn your engine off.
The last thing we want is for the city council and their elected members there to turn into some sort of talking shop with no power. And hopefully it will be going back to that in a couple of years' time. What do you make of the way that we're going to progress from the situation we've got now with the mayor over the next 2 years, going back to the old committee system, Joss?
In my speech, which was pre-written by me, because nobody else writes our speeches, I did say there's two things that I think are probably relevant here. One, that the referendum wasn't about an individual, it was about a system of governance. I think that's quite important. But I also asked in my speech that we could have a managed transition so that we could start moving things forward and changing the culture within the council. But to be honest with you, no chance. I can't see it happening. It'd be lovely if it did, but I can't see it happening.
And the fact that it isn't happening, how is that likely to affect Bristolians?
Probably Bristolians won't notice any difference, to be absolutely honest, because the bins will still get collected, even if we have a transition and to a change. I mean, did people notice when we went from leader and cabinet to mayoral system? Probably not, because everything still functioned, the traffic lights still worked. But obviously within the council, there is a lot of change. There will be a lot of change. I think one of the things, and this is probably a bit off the record, is I think what we need to be watching out for in the next 2 years is that the administration don't tie us into hugely long, complicated contracts that nobody really wants.
Mm.
Well, that's more important.
I mean, if local businesses who are close to the mayor's office have been used to getting nice contracts, then they're likely to try and make sure that those are extended as long as possible beyond now. Yeah, that's a bit concerning. All right, finally, we've got a bit more news this week about bus services. 26 supported bus services facing the axe around the Bristol area, with this pertaining again to WECA, this organisation we mentioned at the start, which is really the Metro Mayor, which is all the neighbouring local authorities as well, which is run by Dan Norris. But this looks like a complete disaster. 26 bus services facing the axe. I mean, these are often in rural areas. They may only have one or two people on that bus, but for those people, it's the only way that they have any kind of contact, really, in country areas with the outside world.
There's a number of things with the buses. I know that when the tenders went out, they came back 42% higher in terms of cost than they obviously had done originally. And that's a lot to do with staffing and fuel, etc. But that's a massive uplift. We don't have enough bus drivers because, oddly enough, they're not necessarily in the country still, because they've left to do other things in a country that's more welcoming than we are. Because of Brexit, a lot of our bus services were cut right back, obviously, because of the pandemic, and they haven't come back to their previous schedule, which is a problem. Bus usage has not gone back to the rates it was at previously. The most fundamental issue with this bus issue is that if we want to get people out of their cars, it's a push-pull issue. At the moment, with the clean air zone, with the councils pushing people out of their cars, they're making it more and more difficult to drive your car. But if you don't give a viable opportunity, then people are going to become resentful. If you give people a really good service, so if I was going into town tonight to do something, and I thought, what's the point in taking my car? The buses are so cheap, they're so reliable, and it comes back when I want to come home. You'd use that. And that's a pull. That's pulling me out of my car. And at the moment, we've got a real challenge where the council wants us to use our cars less and the buses more. But actually, the bus service, I've used the buses a couple of times recently, and I'm not saying they were good. I cannot say they were good.
That's right. I mean, I suppose they're looking to their shareholders really more than they are to the passengers. Look, you've brought that up, that business of the restriction of particularly the diesels that's coming up. Do you know when this is scheduled to come in? Because I've noticed as well, you know, we've got these restricted roads where two lanes in the city centre have now been brought down to one lane. I was watching yesterday an ambulance trying to get through because simply there's great queues of cars in both directions. It's caused an enormous amount of congestion. Everything is moving much more slowly around the city. It's almost as if it's deliberately done to create congestion because so few cars can get across the lights when there's only one lane rather than two, for example. And then an ambulance finds that there's a whole load of pretty much stationary vehicles, and it's taking a hell of a time for people to get. Well, there's nowhere for them to go.
Yeah.
So the ambulances are being enormously delayed by this, and it must be very frustrating for their drivers to see these bollards down the side of the road with kind of nobody there using it, and yet all the cars forced into the middle. So there's two questions really. One is about the forced congestion that's going on in the city centre, and secondly about the implementation of this so-called clean air zone.
So we're just seeing now that some of these road closures are going to be made permanent, and that is nice, but there's a knock-on effect. And we also, there's a big policy within the council about livable neighbourhoods. And again, that's really nice if you live in that area. But in terms of the mitigation, there's very little mitigation. So if that traffic is being pushed into another area and those roads are becoming congested, that makes that environment really quite unpleasant, actually. But I agree with you. I think a lot of this is around making driving become unpalatable, and you just think, oh, I can't do it. And I think livable neighbourhoods is going to be a very similar. There's going to be more livable neighbourhoods brought in where you won't be able to go through or across the city because arterial, you know, quite major roads are going to be not through roads in the future. And that becomes a real problem. The clean air zone, I think in principle, is great. And I think that there's some really positives with it. My concern about it, I obviously live on the periphery. I live in Brissington. A lot of traffic that cannot go, would normally, historically, would have gone into the city and back out, will now be going round. And so they'll be doing more miles on our Bristol roads to get to the same spot. And they'll be going through the residential areas. So they won't be able to go through the city centre, so they will go through residential roads, and that's going to clog up our roads still further. I just think we need to have a really, really good look at public transport. If you want people out of their cars, you've got to give them a really good alternative.
Yeah, I don't think there really is very much at the moment. I mean, for example, in St Werburgh's, there are some of the roads where which people used to park on both sides of the road. They've now been told they can only park on one side, but there's no provision of anywhere that they can go. I mean, most of these roads are, you know, not completely chock-a-block, but fairly busy, and so they're really chasing people to put their cars maybe, I don't know, 15 minutes walk away from their home, because they've deliberately created a situation where there's less parking spaces than that people have got. So this seems to be a really draconian way of bullying, in fact, really, a way of saying people just get rid of your cars, but without really offering, as you've said, very good alternatives.
That is absolutely the key. I cycle a lot. I probably use my push bike more than I do my car. That's fine. I'm fit enough and healthy enough to cycle it, and that's fine for me. But not everybody's in that position. And so we do need to be giving. It's about alternatives. It really is about, and the bus service is absolutely key. And with the bus service as it is currently, I don't think people have confidence in it at the moment, and the service is not good. So why would you use it? So people are going to, you know, hold on to their car. It's a reality. It really is.
Jos Clark, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.